Wherever we look these days, life is full of advertisements that seek to draw us in with very attractive deals and offers. They're presented so well that we'd be foolish not to take up the offer of a prize draw, the holiday of a lifetime, the chance to release some cash from the equity of our house, or the purchase of a car with all the latest technology. If, however, we study the details more closely, we often observe the phrase, terms and conditions apply. Do we, I wonder, always read the small print? How many of us, for example, when signing up to a Microsoft program, tick the box saying we agree to the terms and conditions when we haven't actually read any of the terms and conditions at all? Mind you, they are pretty long if you try and work your way through them. That's designed to put you off, of course, although I didn't really say that. Almost all the offers we have in life have terms and conditions attached to them. There is one hugely influential and life-changing offer that never has terms and conditions. This is God's offer of love in Jesus Christ. His is love, no conditions apply. And that's the essential message from John 15, verses 9 to 17. Love, no conditions apply. You don't have to tick any boxes. It's always there. In this passage, the writer John starts off really dealing with the whole aspect about the love of Christ. And what Jesus does, you find in John's gospel that when Jesus has a metaphor, he never lets go of it. He never uses a metaphor, if you carefully read through, only once. He will come up with a metaphor and then he will extend it. He will add to it. He seems to like doing that. And Jesus can't seem to let go of a metaphor. For example, Jesus refers to himself as the bread of life in John 6. And then later on in the same chapter, he refers to himself as the bread that came down from heaven. So he takes a metaphor and then he extends it. And he's doing the same thing here in John chapter 9. When he talks about the vine and the branches. And what Jesus is doing is he's introducing a theme and then actually filling out the picture that he wants to present. He wants to reflect the reality that in him, the Word made flesh, the grace of God is poured out on the grace of God, is poured out on the grace of God. In other words, it's endless. The grace of God is overflowing towards us and all that he's made. No terms and conditions. And in these verses that we heard read a short time ago, Jesus builds on that foundation by detailing more precisely what the nature of his relationships to his disciples is. And we read in the text, not Jesus just talking to the 12, but as though Jesus is speaking directly to each one of us. He's telling us about the nature of God's love for us, which he imparts to our hearts and shapes the friendship that we share with him. We often use friendship to describe a relationship with someone we don't know all that well. Yeah, we're friends, you know, so we've kind of known them from birth kind of thing. But what Jesus, when he speaks about love and friendship, he's speaking about this agape love of the New Testament. I can remember many, many years ago, people really got kind of fixed on this thing about agape love. You had kind of agape parties, an agape meeting. I don't know if you remember all that. But it became the kind of buzzword as though, oh, we suddenly discovered something. We discovered something about God's love, which was there staring us in the face all the time. It's about self-sacrificial love. That's the love of Christ. And that's the depth of his love for us. And often, I think sometimes we allow it to get obscured in the way we do things in church, because things have a routine about them. And we rather lose track of the wonder and the awesomeness of this love that Jesus has for us. And regardless of our worth, you know, in human life, people are very quick to judge others. You know, oh, that's a nice person, or she's not a very nice person, really. I wouldn't get involved with her if you can avoid it, you know. And or people have peculiarities about the way they are, and we use that as a, oh, hang on a minute, I don't want to get involved in all that. That's not the Jesus way. He just gets involved, because that is the nature of his love. And that love, he invites us to remain in him, remain in my love, he says in verse 9. Some translations say, abide in my love. Yeah, I quite like the sense, abide in my love, has a kind of deeper feel to it. And he uses that image of the vine and the branches to depict that love that he shares with God himself, and which the disciples, of course, are now assured of their presence. This is the same love the Father has for his Son. And this is the astonishing truth, or one of the astonishing truths that comes across in this passage, that Jesus loves us with the same love by which the Father loves him. I mean, you stop and think about that. If I know it's astonishing, but that is what Jesus is saying, that the love he shares with the Father is the love that Jesus offers to us. It's that deep, it's that profound, it's that life-changing. And that this truth has a vitally important task, and that's obedience. As Jesus remains in his Father's love by obedience to his Father's will, so we remain in Jesus' love by obedience to him and to his ways. And that comes from keeping the two great commandments that come up in Matthew chapter 22. You know, somebody asked Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? You know what it's like when you ask Jesus a question. You never get only one answer. And here we have it in Matthew 22. Someone asked him, what is the greatest commandment? And Jesus says, the two great commandments are to love God and love your neighbor. It's no good loving God if you don't love your neighbor. It doesn't work like that. You have to have the two together. And Jesus goes on to explain the outcome of delighting to do God's will by obeying his commandments is that our joy will be complete. Verse 11. And Psalm 98, we heard the whole of Psalm 98 read. It's a call for us to celebrate with joy the righteous reign of the Lord. And this isn't some, you know, cheap kind of glow, sense of kind of feeling good about ourselves. It's about our reaction to wholeheartedly giving ourselves to serve Christ. In the Westminster Confession, which we don't hear very much of these days, the answer to the question, what is the chief end of man? Which includes women, of course, but in those days they weren't so enlightened as we are now. What is the chief end of man? And the answer is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. That's what we're here for. To glorify God and enjoy him forever. And the kind of love that Jesus wants us to have can be seen in the life of the early church. There was such loyalty and friendship shown that people were prepared to lay down their lives for Jesus and each other in love. And in today's world, people outside the church on the fringes still marvel at the response of Christian love. And I don't know whether you've had the experience, but people often have come up to me and said, why did you actually do that? What was that all about? And you know, you're not connected with that person or that situation, but somehow you got involved. And well, it's Jesus' love compels us. That's what Paul writes about, you know. We do it actually without thinking, don't we? If we stop and think about it, we're not constantly saying, right, am I going to get involved in this or am I not? We just do it because that's who we are. That is about remaining in the love of Jesus. And he goes on in the next verses talking about friendship. And Jesus describes his relationship to the disciples as one of friendship. And you can see in John's gospel what's happening here, that Jesus has gone from someone who's a teacher to his disciples, which of course he is in the very early days. He's gone through a relationship of lordship to servant, and now he's moved friend to friend. You see the progression there? He starts off as a teacher, and then Jesus is Lord, and now I have called you friends. I have called you friends. There's a kind of natural progression. Firstly, Jesus wants to really show what his nature is, that he is God on earth, that he is the living Lord. But he still wants to share in human relationships. But they need to understand exactly who Jesus is and what he's about, in order that they can come into the most appropriate friendship. And verse 13, he says, greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. That's a verse that always echoes with us, doesn't it, on Remembrance Sunday. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And Jesus doesn't say, lay down your life for me, but lay down your life for your friends. To belong to Jesus is to be loved by him and show that love in our relationship with others. You are my friends if you remain in my love. Greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. And those are words, of course, that remind us of the true depth to which love in friendship can go. The Christian writer C.S. Lewis, in his book Four Loves, says that to the ancients, friendship was the happiest and most fully human of all loves, the crown of life and the school of virtue. And when Jesus says, you are my friends, he means that we are in a special relationship with him, where we not only know God's commands, but through the Holy Spirit working in our hearts, we carry out the Father's will and purpose with complete understanding and approval. True, deep friendship on the human level is about total commitment. We know that ourselves in the relationships we have, that we stay with someone through the thick and thin and the ups and downs of life, and there's plenty of those. There's plenty of thick and thin, and there's plenty of ups and downs. But we stay whatever happens. And Jesus has a commitment to us, and we do to him. And Jesus also talks about fruit. One thing I know about, I don't know an awful lot about fruit, but I do know this, that it doesn't last. I've lost count of the number of times I keep buying bananas. I don't know why. Every time we go in a shop, I buy bananas for some reason or other. And of course, in our younger days, you couldn't get bananas all the year round, but now you can. I do know they go off very quickly, and especially if it's a little bit warm. And the problem is, too, that the gas that bananas give off, which is ethylene, it gives off ethylene gas, that makes other fruit also go off. So in other words, you have all this fruit stored up like I do in a kind of random way, you know, in the kitchen or in the pantry or whatever it is. And you go back a few days later, oh, heavens, all that fruit's gone off. The bananas have gone black. Everything else is inedible because it's been kept too close by. And there is in Christian work some fruit that doesn't last. Much of it may be pleasant to see, great to have done, but it doesn't leave any mark on the world, the church, or human lives. I used to be involved in an awful lot of missions, but I remember one mission in particular when a fairly large number of us went to a town in the north of England. No comments about people south of the border, please. Anyway, we were doing this mission in a town in the north of England, which I'm not going to mention, fairly obviously, and there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. I mean, you know, enthusiasm, this had gone bonkers. I mean, yeah, all sorts of people involved. There were a whole lot of events organised, and they were well attended. There was a lot of talking. There was a lot of information handed out. There was a lot of prayer, you know, meetings all over the place. And church attendance marginally rose for a short time. But did the life in the town or individual lives in the town observably change on a permanent basis? No. There was just a lot of talk, but there wasn't any commitment. You know, they were just talking about it. It's nice to have a chat about it, but didn't want to do anything practically. And this is what Jesus is saying. It's all about doing things practically. You can be committed to the ends of the earth, but you have to see it in real life. Fruit reveals the nature of the tree from which it comes. And what's the secret of bearing fruit that will last? Well, this passage introduces us to spiritual fruitfulness. We're called Jesus' friends. We're objects of his love. And he chose us, you know, as we are here in church in Pitlochry this morning, Jesus has chosen you. I mean, if you stop and think about it, there's quite something, isn't there? Jesus has actually chosen me and you to bear fruit that will last. It's not just these 12 guys here that Jesus is talking to. He's actually talking to us. And he's inviting us into an intimacy of relationship, not a casual, just a casual getting to know, but really getting to the heart of what it means to be a friend of Jesus and to bear fruit. Some want lasting fruit to be measured by lives brought to Christ in evangelism. Others talk about it showing the fruit of the Spirit that counts. But both those things are too narrow. There used to be a big movement in the States about the big nine, you know, nine fruits of the Spirit. And you had people kind of evangelizing about, you know, get to grips with the big nine. Yeah, well, okay, jolly good. But it didn't last. In fact, all these things, it's all buzzy, 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 but there's not really any commitment at the end of it. And here, Jesus is really saying, hey, all that stuff's too narrow. Fruit is everything that conforms to the will of Jesus Christ. Not just the odd thing we do, but the totality of who we are. Loving one another because of Jesus is Christian fruit. So is praying in his name. Everything in our lives that brings glory to the Father is Christian fruit. So, summing up, love, no conditions apply. Some time ago, I was involved in a dispute between two groups of people. Both were convinced that their particular positions on an issue were correct. We often get involved in that, don't you know? You've got two groups of people. They're right, and they're right as well. Right, okay. They're right, and they're right. Right, how are we going to resolve this one? And neither side was going to give way. And I got asked for my advice. You know, this is the kind of thing you don't really want to get involved in, do you? What's your advice? You think, oh, heck. I was hoping just to pass by on the other side here. And I said to one group, you have to make the first move in reconciliation. But why not them? Someone immediately said from the group. Because as Christians, we have to be prepared to make the first move, irrespective of the rights and wrongs. And you are the Christian group. You have got to make the first move. And we've seen from John 15 that Jesus calls us friends. Everything I learned from my Father, I have made known to you. In other words, the totality of who Jesus is in his relationship to the Father, he has revealed to us. And what's he revealed? The godliness, whatever that means, really, because we've only a fleeting idea of it, really. the godliness of God, the power to forgive, the initiative in accepting those who are not easy to deal with, to love the unlovable. And as friends of Jesus, God in effect is saying to us, he and we both are subjects undergoing the passion and pain of love. We are here to love each other and our neighbour. But love that, you can't command love like that. You can't instruct someone to have love like that. It comes only as Christ's Spirit is working in our hearts. And the command to love is Bible language for the Father wills that the children of God love and give themselves freely to one another and to all. There's no other way to love. It's done freely from the heart. It's our nature, or it's not love. It's love where no conditions apply. Amen.